On Tuesday, the news broke. You may not be able to see it way back there, but the headline here says, Pastor Terrorized Kids. The youth pastor, the son-in-law of the pastor of the Glad Tidings Assembly of God, made the front page. He was charged with false imprisonment and simple assault on the church's teenagers. The youth pastor, Andrew Jordan, had hoped to give his youth empathy for what the Christian experience might be in some places of the world. Also in the back of his mind was the idea that if some of these young people were to decide to go on a mission trip, they might want to be forewarned of what could happen. Well, what happened in this event? Well, while there is a bit of he said, she said involved in this early account that I read, during a youth group meeting, the lights suddenly went out. Masked men barged into a room with assault rifles. They put pillowcases over the kids' faces and heads, and they took the young people out into vans and carted them away, and finally, when they were allowed to see what was around them, they were in a windowless basement, and there was a curtain drawn between them and where their youth pastor was, evidently being tortured. Made all the sounds of that, and threats were being made up on to make him look all bruised and bloodied. Can you imagine what that would have done to your kids? I can't imagine what it would have done to me. The Lancaster New Era put it this way: while the church's and Jordan's intentions were not necessarily harmful, they in essence terrorized several children. One girl who happened to be visiting the church ended up with a cut lip, bruises on both legs, as well as feeling terrified by rape threats. Still not sure how all this will turn out. Reading about Pastor Jordan's episode, my mind drifted to my friend who I met when I was a freshman at Laverne College way back in 1963. Yes, there was such a thing. He was recently released from prison after being caught by a sting operation. He was charged with a criminal attempt of unlawful contact with a minor. Mind you, this was an ordained minister, a leader in the academic world, taught in a college not far from here, passionately engaged in his denomination and in his local church. He was known for his contributions to church history and his care. He was known for his contributions to church history and his care and support of many Christian endeavors. Now that he's out of jail, he cannot find a job, and even churches are slow to reach out to him. His entire former life is cut off, and he's trying to find his place again in life. Well, what happens when well-intentioned people who would define themselves as moral and spiritually sensitive ruin their own lives and the lives of others? Now, evil, of course, is not just found in the decisions we make. Evil is all around us. It happens in natural disasters. I've just started reading a book called Cutting for Stone by Abraham Verghese. And in the first chapter, after a list of catastrophes that leaves the heroines baffled by all the death and destruction around her, the author writes about the heroine, Sister Mary Joseph Praise. God used Satan to show her how fragile and fragmented the world was, and how delicate the balance of evil and good, and how naive she was in her faith. We try to avoid thinking about it, but evil is a reality in life, isn't it? People do evil deeds in this world, and we are disaster that we would call evil. Our home burning down, our marriage breaking up, or tornado or hurricane, power outage, well, the list can go on and on. You could keep adding to it. But we're not alone in this. Life is even more precarious in the underdeveloped countries. Mark Myers over there, who's distracted for the moment, he could probably tell you about from his travels to Haiti and other places that we have it really pretty good. The fact is, like Sister Mary Joseph prays, we're pretty sheltered and naive. Let's delve into the shadow side a spell. Carl Jung suggested we all have one, a shadow side, and Star Wars popularized it as all are equally capable of good and evil. We try to deny it. We cover it up when folks come around, but there it is. In most cases, we work hard to cultivate ways to cope with the evil within. Our senses of values and ethics and morality are all part of the evil within. Our senses of values and ethics and morality are all part of our defense. Tapping into spiritual resources is part of our defense, similar to the prayer that Jesus taught in Matthew's version, where he said, "Do not put us into positions of enticement, but rescue us from evil." You probably remember that from your memorization days. It says, "Lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil." But wait, did you catch that? Have you ever really thought about it? Something about the way it flits off the tips of our tongues, we say it so frequently, disturbing curiosity. Why would we have to ask God not to put us in positions of enticement unless God did such things? Surely not. Now bear in mind that the Greek word translated as positions of enticement can also be translated as test. Do not put us to the test. Or it could be translated tempt. Do not lead us into temptation. To us. Does God ever do it to us? Well, there's one example in the Bible where we have an example where he did it. It's a story of Job. You remember that. It's in the Old Testament, just about right before Psalms, I think, somewhere there. God's heavenly prosecuting attorney, you remember his name was Satan, he put Job to the test by basically destroying his life to see if he would betray his loyalty to God. Satan lost that case. Job remained faithful to the end. So what are we to make of this notion that the design of life is such that we are put into positions of enticement? I got a call this week that may help clarify it. Our daughter Jennifer was really excited about a developmental step of our 2-year-old grandson. Notice I did say our, not my. Please bear witness to this in case it ever comes up again. In spite of the harried and frenetic pace of life, as they were getting ready for school that day, Joshua, that 2-year-old going to school, Joshua is eager to take some bottle tops. He wanted to take them to the school collection. They had this large jug with a, like a water jug, like an empty thing, and he would get to put them in one at a time and watch them plop down to the bottom. He just loved that. He was so looking forward to it. Just as they got to the container, another 2-year-old came up and realized that he had forgotten to bring his bottle tops. Jennifer said to him, "Would you like to share yours?" To a 2-year-old. Joshua offered them all to his friend. Now you see why she called. Of teaching her young son the value of generosity, Jennifer put Joshua into a position of enticement, into a test. He could have gone either way, but he yielded his 2-year-old self-centeredness and exercised empathy for his friend, or maybe not even friend, his classmate. In this case, the position of enticement was a developmental moment. The little one took another step in the creation of his social values, another step to maturity. Perhaps divine testing is of that nature. a providential tool to cultivate maturity in us. I'm not saying, I'm just simply wondering out loud. But if I'm right, these enticements develop character, right? Well, not necessarily. Sometimes we are enticed to the dark side, as happened dramatically to my college roommate and to this youth pastor I told you about. And even to a lesser degree, it's happened to me. If we accept that in this life there is a universal truth to Abraham Vigee's assessment of Sister Mary Joseph Praise, we can recast it as how fragile and fragmented the world is, how delicate the balance between evil and good, and how naive we are in our faith. And once we've done that, then the enticements we all experience threaten our well-being, and we need to be rescued if we want to ensure our safe passage through this life. Now, I'm coming to an understanding the sentence of the disciples' prayer to mean that enticements are, in fact, a universal reality of life. And I focus upon the second half of the sentence, rescue us from evil. Now, here I'm caught by the smallest of the words, us. Notice we are not taught to pray, rescue me from evil. Whoa. That's something. What a thought. Enticements, of course, seldom come to us as good against evil. I mean, frankly, if evil were staring in the face trying to entice you, you'd run the other direction, right? So would I. I mean, we all know how to recognize evil. So the issues are seldom a matter of between good and evil. Usually it comes between shades of good. And one decision builds upon another until we can lose our perspective. If we make a shadowy decision, a little more shaded, a little more shaded, we can lose our perspective on just how fragile and fragmented our world is. And soon then we lose our ability to make the decision between the delicate balance between evil and good. And we need to be rescued. But by then we don't even know we need to be rescued. So praying, rescue us from evil, is a way of recognizing that we are in this together as a faith community. Over and again in the Gospel of Matthew, we are drawn toward awareness of the role of a healthy faith community for the spiritual and relational development of its people. One of the most important roles of the church is its ability to help us make the decisions when we face these enticements. But it requires that we swallow our arrogant pride to gain the perspective of other people. It means we're willing to risk struggling with difficult issues with other people. It requires being in conversation with each other about the issues that matter to us and being open to the views about the issues that matter to us and being open to the views we may not want to hear. Now, we brethren have long taught that in community God's voice is discerned most clearly. If that's true, then the way God rescues us from life's enticements is through honest, frank, and deep conversation with the people we've come to trust. The role of the church is to learn to cultivate such trustworthiness and to cultivate opportunities of just such kinds of conversations. Decades ago, I saw this very kind of thing happening in this congregation, and I'll bet you still do it. But I have to wonder, how conscious and intentional are you about the way you're doing this, helping each other to talk about these enticements? When your commission meetings are taking place, are you exploring how you can help these conversations take place? Now, I could see these conversations taking place to help each other in these life decisions in the kitchen. Well, maybe not at the moment. In the kitchen while you're preparing for a congregational meal, or at the Gathering Place Cafe chatting with customers or with each other. or even outside of church, just in casual conversations. Building trust, supportively, humbly, and with integrity. I know. Life is already too full. You have too many bigger issues you're faced with, you think. But perhaps that's the very reason the world is so fragile and fragmented. And perhaps that's why there's such a delicate balance between evil and good, and precisely why we are so naive in our faith. Well, my job is merely to open up a possibility for you, which I think I've done. Yours is to consider it, think about it, and if you think it's reasonable, to act upon it. So now it's your move. So to help you think about it, why don't we do that while we receive the morning offering?